Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never. And that debt is fraud. And we need to maintain our appeals to heaven and maintain our learning. Because, folks, you know, I don't know, there's an old movie, and I forget what it's called. And welcome back, Tammy, because maybe you know, maybe you've seen this movie. John Goodman is in it. Don Johnson is in it. And I think it's Melanie Griffith that's in it. And John Goodman, the husband of Roseanne, in that show Roseanne, he plays this mean corporate executive who has arm candy. He's not married, but he has this, you know, this trophy girlfriend that he adorns with minks and diamonds. He just, you know, spends lots of money on her. And he's getting more and more engaged and involved in politics in D.C. And because he has her, you know, on his arm, he gets embarrassed because she doesn't know anything. She's not that educated. So he goes off and hires Don Johnson to basically tutor her. And instead, Don Johnson educates her on, you know, not just basic understanding of, you know, how to behave, but he actually educates her in how to judge and critically look at things. To where by the time, you know, she gets to that, you know, that point in the lesson where she realizes that this guy is bad news and, you know, and she wants to abandon, you know, the way she's living because she starts realizing. I mean, there's this one line in the movie where Don Johnson goes, you know, what's good or, you know, what do you value? And she goes, well, I value my minks. I value because these things mean they cost a lot of money. And having these is, you know, important. And so.
What's it called? Born Yesterday? Is that what it is?
You're looking it up?
Yeah.
It may be that. It might be that. If Don Johnson and Goodman, and it's about, I'd say it was done in the 80s.
Yeah, it says 1993.
Okay, that might be it. Born Yesterday. And so it's a really good movie to watch to help somebody kind of see what happens when they really start understanding the real picture, not just because what John Goodman wanted is he wanted her to be able to articulate and still be his arm candy. But when she finally realized, you know, what she was just, you know, an object of him, you know, that he was controlling by buying her, by basically, you know, adorning her with the things that she, you know, like with a monkey, what does a monkey consider valuable? Bananas, you know, and so, okay, so she considered the minks and all these adornments and so forth valuable. And it's a powerful message that was done. And so anyway, that's the whole point, why it is important to learn and understand the Constitution as best as we possibly can. Because the more we understand it, the more we really start to see, you know, the bigger problem and what we need to do. Does that make sense? And as
sure,
a matter of fact,
like picking apart all those small little things that.
Yeah, absolutely. So, really, we've been working together. You've been, you know, assisting on the show here for about a year now.
Has it been that long?
About a year. I think it's been about a year, yeah. Because it was last summer when you started reading. It was after the ratification debates. And so out of that time, and now that you're actually reading the ratification debates, I think every time you read them, you're getting a little bit more.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I mean,
getting better.
Well, this is the. Well, I'm thinking that you're actually seeing how the framers are describing the problems of the time, you know, and how they're making obvious statements that never get taught in school, like the dependency of the Southern states' money for the northern states to be able to, you know, fund a military to defend themselves if necessary.
Yeah.
That interdependency between these states, in other words, it's kind of like, you know, the old saying, politics makes interesting bedfellows, because it was the politics of maintaining the Union that forced these people who hated slavery to actually allow slavery to come into the Union, because they felt that they had this dependency, the importance of the Union. Now, again, hindsight being 2020, I truly believe that if they let those southern states, those three states, and they abolished slavery, and the three southern states went on their own, it wouldn't have been long before the rest of Europe would have realized that they had been segregated and that now they're ripe for the pickings. And so at that point, they either capitulate and surrender themselves back to Britain and go through the painful process of, you know, because if Britain takes control of those three states, there's going to be people hanged. Because Britain is not happy with the fact that they got away with treason, because what they did was treason. And so they probably would have, I think those three states would have done everything not to go back to Britain. And I think that they probably would have, you know, at that point in time, been forced to get rid of slavery. Because either they maintain slavery and get overtaken, or they free the slaves and they move forward in defending themselves and then coming back into the Union. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, and these are just little nuances that literally jump off these pages. You know, the issues of slavery, the issues of the currency, you know, and the paper fiat money, and the importance of using a gold species. We haven't even gotten into those arguments because, obviously, you know, Massachusetts wasn't too concerned on the financial side. You're going to actually see these arguments come out more in some of the other states, because the first two states were more religious, good people. And so anyway, back to the obligatories, folks, that's why it's so important to continue to learn, pray, and act. As the better we understand things, the more specific our prayers get. It's all about everything we're doing. It's all about compliance of the Constitution. In a big picture, we demand full compliance. We're not here to take one thing and say, this is the most important thing. I think anybody that's out there doing that, whether it's the Convention of States or the Convention of Counties, you know, or whether it is the Second Amendment folks, or whether it's the abortion or the education, the DEI, everybody that's out there trying to get you to believe that this one issue is more important than full compliance of the Constitution is the big deceiver. They're all deceiving you, trying to get you to basically waste time on something that if we all actually united together and demanded full compliance of the Constitution, these problems would go away quickly.
Right.
If we united as a people and we said no more division, no more factions, the party, all parties, you know, actually not all parties, but every state Republican Party says it's all about constitutional compliance. They get rid of their platforms of platitudes. They get rid of all of these little divisive things and say, we demand full compliance. If you don't have the authority, you can't do it anymore. That's it. And that is actually when the earth shakes. It's that easy, folks. There's no doubt in my mind. You want to see the earth shake, get everybody to stop. I mean, there's so much money in this. And every person that's out there like monkeys on a string dancing to the organ grinder, trying to continue to entertain you, to keep you engrossed in doing what they're doing. And so I hope everybody starts to see this as the real evil, you know, in what's really going on. So as we kind of get back to where we were, we kind of stopped on, I think it was Major Lusk. Actually, I don't think we covered what Major Lusk said, which is fine. Reverend Backus is the next person up. Oh, and let me not forget. I would love to work with you. If you really care about, you know, stepping forward and stepping constitutionally, the 2028 election is coming. Let's start actually forcing the argument, because the popular vote, folks, as a matter of fact, we already have a popular vote. And the popular vote has been the problem, because the popular vote has guaranteed that the only people that will make it to the final election are those who the globalists have allowed.
Mm-hmm.
They are not going to let somebody like me ever make it to that ballot. And that should actually upset you, because what we need, what America needs, are champions of the Constitution, not managers of their agenda. And that's why their agenda has continued to move forward. So now we can move forward. Just contact me and how you can start working with your state Secretary of State in getting your name as an elector onto the ballot and taking that away from the party, so that the parties no longer dictate who the electors will be. We the people will. And that's where we actually start forcing ourselves to actually get engaged in the real candidates and what they stand for. Because then we're actually making the wiser choices, because if we listen to the party primary process, then it's all about this infighting, platitudes, and everything else. And that's how the smokescreen has completely diverted and has gotten us away from following the constitutional process. Okay, so Mr. Backus starts off his diatribe, his oration regarding religious tests. So let's go ahead and dive into that.
Okay. Mr. President, I have said very little in this honorable convention, but I now beg leave to offer a few thoughts upon some points in the Constitution proposed to us, and I shall begin with the exclusion of any religious tests. Many appear to be much concerned about it, but nothing is more evident, both in reason and the Holy Scriptures, than that religion is ever a matter between God and individuals, and therefore no manner men can impose any religious test without invading the essential prerogatives of our Lord Jesus Christ. Ministers first assumed this power under the Christian name, and then Constantine approved the practice when he adopted the profession of Christianity as an engine of state policy. And let the history of all nations be searched from that day to this, and it will appear that the imposing of religious tests has been the greatest engine of tyranny in the world. That's true. And I rejoice to see so many gentlemen who are now giving in their rights of conscience in this great and important matter. Some serious minds discover a concern lest, if all religious tests should be excluded, the Congress would hereafter establish popery or some other tyrannical way of worship, but it is most certain that no such way of worship can be established without any religious test.
Yeah, so popery being, you know, the arch enemy, Catholics to the
right.
To the Puritans, right? So, yeah, absolutely, he's correct that the concept of religious test has been it's how we divide ourselves. It's one of the big dividers,
mm-hmm.
Right? And as he says, and you know, I kind of highlighted this with red as we've gone along, that religion is ever a matter between God and individuals, and therefore no man or men can impose any religious test without invading the essential prerogatives of our Lord Jesus Christ. Anyway.
Yeah, what an inspired statement.
Yes.
Wow.
You know, to the Puritans at that. Because, and that's what I'm telling you. As you look at these debates, what really matters is what these guys are fighting about. What really matters to the Puritans had far more to do with the spiritual matters than it did financial, than it did commerce. I mean, they talked about those things, but now we're getting into the summation. This is the end of the debates, where they're making their final pitches, and the majority of the final pitches were literally religious. So let's keep going. Go ahead.
Okay. Much, sir, hath been said about the importation of slaves into this country. I believe that, according to my capacity, no man abhors that wicked practice more than I do. I would gladly make use of all lawful means towards the abolishing of slavery in all parts of the land, but let us consider where we are and what we are doing. In the Articles of Confederation, no provision was made to hinder the importation of slaves into any of these states, But a door is now open hereafter to do it, and each state is at liberty now to abolish slavery as soon as they please. And let us remember our former connection with Great Britain, from whom many in our land think we ought not to have revolted. How did they carry on with this? How did they carry on the slave trade? I know that the Bishop of Gloucester, in an annual sermon in London in February 1776, endeavored to justify their tyrannical claims of power over us by casting the reproach of the slave trade upon the Americans. But at the close of the war, the Bishop of Chester, in an annual sermon in February 1783, ingenuously owned that their nation is the most deeply involved in the guilt of that trade of any nation in the world, and also that they have treated their slaves in the West Indies worse than the French or Spaniards have done theirs. Thus slavery grows more and more odious through the world, and as an honorable gentleman said some days ago, though we cannot say that slavery is struck with an apoplexy, yet we may hope it will die with a consumption. And a main sorcerer of that iniquity hath been an abuse of the covenant of circumcision, which gave the seed of Abraham to destroy the inhabitants of Canaan, and to take their houses, vineyards, and all their estates as their own, and also to buy and hold others as servants. And his Christian privileges are greater than those of the Hebrews were. Many have imagined that they have a right to seize upon the lands of the heathen and to destroy or enslave them as far as they could extend their power.
Okay, so let me just interrupt you.
Okay.
Because you covered so much, and I was actually looking for a spot, and this is just boom, 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 boom. So one of the points that he points out right at the very top of this is in the Articles of Confederation, no provision was made to hinder the importation of slaves. You know, going back to the Declaration of Independence, because we're literally a month away, folks, from reading that. I'll be reading that to you, and I'm going to read you Thomas Jefferson's original draft. And in the original draft, he talks about the manipulation that the king had done with slavery here in America to basically try to pit the slaves against us. And how he basically has created this dichotomy between, you know, black slaves only in America and the white inhabitants. In other words, creating this racial tension, because everywhere else in the world, slavery was open to all creeds, nations, kindreds, and tongues. You know, if you got captured and you were put into a slave, there it wasn't just black and white like it was in America. So, and as a matter of fact, the majority of the people in slavery at this time, when you really look at it, were white. You know, not contrary to what we learn in history, there were 22 slaves and serfs in Russia at the time of the Civil War, in contrast to what the 6, maybe 9 million blacks in America. And that's only Russia. Now, we know in South Africa, it was a black-white
22
issue.
22 million, you mean?
Yes, didn't I say 22 million?
I said 22.
Oh, okay. 22 million serfs and slaves in Africa. And when we look at the majority of the Ottoman Empire, the majority of the Ottoman Empire was all white. The slaves they had in the Ottoman Empire were all white. And they preferred the Urals or the people, the big, strong Ukrainians and such out of that Ural area, because they were big, strong, and dumb. And so they made the perfect slave, which if you actually go through Thomas Sowell's Black Rednecks, White Liberals book, he talks about the process of the slaves going to the Ottoman Empire, where they would all be basically castrated before they were marched to the Ottoman Empire. 90% of the people, of the men, died. But the yield was worth it for the people that had to go. I mean, think about it. 90% of the people you actually spent the time to go out, you know, and use force to capture, captivate, and start dragging on the trail, 90% of these people are going to die.
And still, the payment for, you know, eunuchs or neutered, you know, slaves, you know, was worth it. They would rather, they would pay for the eunuchs. They wouldn't pay for the, you know, very, there was a low demand for, you know, a fully equipped man, if you know what I mean. So,
sure, because then they would have more testosterone and they'd be more dangerous.
Well, there's that plus, you know, the ability to, you know, mingle the blood.
Sure.
You know, and, yeah, and so forth. Because in the true paradigm, you know, when we look at how Portugal and Spain subjugated the states or the nations south of us or the land of South America, Central America, and even Mexico, you know, these men completely raped and ravaged all of the women. Whether they were married or not, it didn't matter. They went and impregnated them so that they would actually create, and this was very subversive, to create this tie to say, you can't hate your children because they're us as well. Right, which it's a way of subduing people because they hate you. They hate, you know, that all these things that you're doing. But eventually, over the course of 10, 15, 20 years, there's enough of the children running around that their father is, you know, these bad guys that, you know, it forces this change. It creates a whole new culture. And it completely undermines the people and their rigidity of rejecting this culture. So, and actually, the, if anybody watched Braveheart, if you watch,
I was just going to say that. Right. I just watched that the other day, and that was the comment. If we can't,
yes, if we can't, that's exactly.
Kill them off, we'll breed them out.
That's right. So it's So that's how evil. So going back to this statement here, and he talks about this sermon by the Bishop of Gloucester in London, basically identifying and clearly admitting that England was the most atrocious slave nation in the world. Wow. How come the history books are not pointing this out?
How come they're teaching the kids nowadays in college and high school that we're the racist ones?
Right.
And clearly, in the ratification debates, they were not.
Correct.
They wanted to end slavery.
Yes. And so the bottom line is that Britain has been a master manipulator for generations, well before this nation even started. And they were the recipient of a lot of that from Rome and the other nations. As Britain kind of went through their metamorphosis, you know, legal, government, and everything else, because again, they were pagan. They were just a bunch of idiots, you know, on the rocks out there in the Northern Atlantic, on these isles. And so, you know, nobody ever saw, you know, the need, and nobody ever gave them much credence because they were just so pig-headed. They were, you know, illiterate, dumb, blah, blah, blah. And so when they were conquered by the Romans and brought into the Roman Empire in, you know, within the first century after Christ, then, you know, from that point, was a slow evolution of educating them and, you know, helping them basically, like I said, metamorphose into this biblical monarchical theocracy under the king, from King Henry. And from that point on, you know, the crown has just done everything they possibly can, manipulating their own people and manipulating the world as they became the world emperor or the empire of the world. Anyway, and this is the irony. Can you just think about this? This is the smallest nation ever formed in the world that's actually controlled the entire world. There was the statement that the sun never set on the British Empire. And so we're going into a break here, so hold on. We'll have to come back after this. But my point is that Britain, you know, this little teeny nation, much smaller than Egypt, much smaller than even Rome, became the master of the world in the last days. This says a lot to, you know, how evil can really create a powerhouse, especially if they coerce or get co-opt everybody. We'll be right back, folks.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so what I was trying to say is that Britain basically started corrupting people, and it's through the corruption that that's how they took a hold of nations. When we look today at how China has created an economic dominance with their trade with most all nations in the world, that's all been done through even a more advanced corruption than ever. And so, and they were able to do that because they basically came in, corrupted the government by basically paying them off. And then once they had control of the government, it was all over. Now they're in bed with the devil and the money hasn't really flowed anymore and they're under control. And so most people think, oh, well, look at all the money and you know, all the advantages I'm going to have. As soon as they assume control, you've lost all advantage. When Pol Pot took over Cambodia and basically, you know, started ruling under his rule, the Khmer Rouge, he killed most everybody that was a real threat to him. Anybody that was educated, anybody that had, if you were old and you had some wisdom and history, that's why they called it the killing fields. They just killed everybody that was truly a threat.
Yeah.
So that is historically how it's done. And and England was one of the, I think they were the king, or I should say they've been the exemplar of a corrupt empire, a corrupt dynasty. I mean, all of them were. I mean, look at, you know, Rome, Egypt, all of them were bad. I mean, they were all corrupt, evil. But Britain kind of took this new age evil on to go just, you know, how repulsive. I mean, look at these days now where we have live organ harvesting. That never happened. You know, the inhumane things that they do. Anyway, and it's all being done, and I'm just telling you folks that even though China may have this empire and they're doing all of these types of things, they're just the proving ground for the globalists, because the 15-minute city is what they want to do here. They're not showing you how evil. They're just trying to sell you on these real good ideas of making life easier, living, you know, everything's within 15 minutes.
Yeah.
Anyway.
You can live in Wyoming and have that available.
Yeah.
If you live in a small enough town.
Yes. Yep. But it's very limited of what you have available within your 15 minutes. Anyway, okay, so go ahead and pick it up where you were. I just wanted to point out these two things regarding the Articles of Confederation and how it became, you know, the obvious statement in England was the tyrant regarding slavery of the world. Go ahead.
Okay. And from thence, the mystery of iniquity carried many into the practice of making merchandise of slaves and souls of men. But all ought to remember that when God promised the land of Canaan to Abraham and his seed, he let him know what they were not to take possession of that land until the iniquity of the Amorites was full. And then they did it under the immediate direction of heaven, and they were as real executors of the judgment of God upon those heathens as any person ever was an executor of a criminal justly condemned. And in doing it, they were not allowed to invade the lands of the Edomites, who sprang from Esau, who was not only of the seed of Abraham, but was born at the same birth with Israel, and yet they were not of that church. Neither were Israel allowed to invade the lands of the Moabites or of the children of Ammon, who were the seed of Lot. And no officer in Israel had any legislative power, but such as were immediately inspired. Even David, the man after God's own heart, had no legislative power, but only as he was inspired from above, and he was expressly called a prophet in the New Testament. And we are to remember that Abraham and his seed for 400 years had no warrant to admit any stranger into that church, but by buying of him as a servant with money. And it was a great privilege to be bought and adopted into a religious family for 7 years, and then to have their freedom. And that covenant was expressly repealed in various parts of the New Testament, and particularly in the first epistle to the Corinthians, where it said, "Ye are bought with a price, therefore glorify God in your body and in your spirit, which are God's." And again, "Circumcision is nothing, and uncircumcision is nothing, but keeping of the commandments of God. Ye are bought with a price, but not ye the servants of men." Thus the gospel sets all men upon a level very contrary to the declaration of an honorable gentleman in this house, that the Bible was contrived for the advantage of a particular order of men.
Okay. Keep going.
"Another great advantage, sir, in the Constitution before us is its excluding all titles of nobility or hereditary succession of power, which hath been a main engine of tyranny in foreign countries. But the American Revolution was built upon the principle that all men are both with an equal right to liberty and property, and that officers have no right to any power but what is fairly given them by the consent of the people. And in the Constitution now proposed to us, a power is reserved to the people constitutionally to reduce every officer again to a private station, and what a guard is, and what a guard is this against their invasion of others' rights or abusing of their power. Such a door is now open for the establishment of righteous government and for the securing equal liberty as never was before open to any people upon earth."
Okay, so let me ask you this. Now that we read this, and just think about this, when did the practice begin for the federal government to actually protect former presidents? In other words, having a Secret Service and this concept that former presidents needed to be guarded against. Let me ask you, is that not a violation of this title of nobility?
Yeah, it would seem to be, yes.
Absolutely. To be clear, it all really started when they started aggrandizing the government in emoluments and compensation that extended into retirement and those types of things. Kind of like the corporate world, when in the corporate world you can receive, you know, these different stations, you can receive a retirement, you know, and other benefits and so forth. Why did we allow the government to basically adorn themselves with things that should have been private sector only?
Yeah, when did that start, you know?
Well, I don't know when it started, but I do know that, you know, when we had these assassination attempts and successes such as McKinley and so forth, that they said, "Oh, well, we got to do this." But bottom line is that every time they get granted themselves, you know, compensation like retirement and those types of things, we could go find this out. The fact is that the Constitution doesn't allow that type of compensation. The Constitution is clear that they're to be receive compensation for their time of service. That's it. Not a retirement for their time of service or anything like that. So this kind of goes in line with the same thing as the copyrights and patents. You know, the Constitution gave them the ability to offer for limited times copyrights. And today, everything is permanently copyrighted. And as a matter of fact, so I could just go down this rat hole and I'll just say many modern day artists, musical artists, are selling their catalogs to lock down the profit base and these copyrights to basically make these things perpetual, and that they will control the use of that music and keep it from anybody being able to have. Now, that's one thing if they do that in another nation, but the United States and the Constitution allows the federal government to create copyrights and patents for limited times. This concept of perpetual, that is all unconstitutional. The fact that they've granted them the ability to do this, why do they do this? Because they're, you know, it, these people who make more money pay them to do it. Does that make sense? I mean, corporations, if you kind of look at, you know, pharmaceutical companies or medical, when they have to spend, you know, 20 years of research, and then they have a patent of maybe 10, 12 years before, you know, other companies can generic. Why doesn't that apply to software? Why isn't that applying to songs? Why is that not applying to everything? As a matter of fact, I think that those time constraints are way too long. And as a matter of fact, the federal government says they create these regulations upon these medical pharmaceutical companies to say, you've got to do this level of testing and this, this, and this. And as far as I'm concerned, they don't have the authority to do that. I mean, most people may look at that and it may seem like it's a good idea, but really is it? Because when we actually see what the pharmaceutical companies are doing, they're literally just riding the fence as close as they possibly can to giving us crap that kills us. It doesn't just randomly or just, you know, quickly go out and kill us, but it starts, they all have these ill effects, side effects, and so forth, you know. And they're actually buying up the patents and concepts of, you know, therapies and those types of treatments that actually cure us. So that you don't have that. Why? It's not about our health. We already know these things. So anyway, all right. So that wraps up Mr. Backus, Reverend Backus. Then Mr. Jarvis kind of speaks, and he kind of goes on a little bit. They break for the day. Mr. Ames and Mr. Beryl, Dr. Taylor, Parsons. And then they go in on February 6th, and Reverend Stillman decides he's going to speak in behalf of the Constitution and delegated powers. So this right here is another long dissertation, but this clearly he goes into, again, Reverend Stillman with a kind of a spiritual view of delegations of powers and so forth. So go ahead.
Okay. The powers that are granted to Congress by this instrument are great and extensive, but, sir, they are defined and limited, and in my judgment, sufficiently checked, which I shall prove before I sit down. These powers have been the subject of long and ingenuous debate, but the arguments that have been made use of against delegating these powers to the general government prove too much, being applicable to all delegated power.
You know what?
I mean the possible...
You know what?
Yeah.
So there's actually a comment by Reverend Stillman that's actually above this that was missed.
Oh, okay.
And so if you actually click on Reverend Stillman, his name, it'll take you to the top of the page of Reverend Stillman. And he says, Mr. President, I arise with deference to gentlemen of superior abilities to give my opinion on present. So as he starts this oration, he actually... the highlighted part really starts at the bottom of that page. And then, so there's this little section that I highlighted that we kind of missed. That's because I never put a subsection to this. So forgive me, but I think we want to cover this right here. Okay.
Wait, so where do you want me to read it?
So it is at the bottom of page 116, folks. And it says, quote, before my departure for the federal convention, close quote.
Okay, gotcha. Before my departure for the Federal Convention, says he, I believe that the Confederation was not so eminently defective as it had been supposed, but after I had entered into a free conversation with those who were best informed of the condition and interests of each state, after I had compared the intelligence derived from them with the proper priorities that ought to characterize the government of our union, I became persuaded that the Confederation was destitute of every energy which a Constitution of the United States ought to possess. And after he had in the most masterly manner proved its insufficiency, he adds, "But now, sir, permit me to declare that in my humble judgment the powers by which alone the blessings of a general government can be accomplished cannot be interwoven in the Confederation without a change of its very essence, or in other words, that the Confederation must be thrown aside." Having stated his objections to it, he proceeds thus: "My inference from these facts and principles is that the new powers must be deposited in a new body growing out of the consolidation of the Union as far as the circumstances of the states would allow. Thus fully and candidly does this gentleman insist on the absolute necessity of a new constitution of general government at the very time that he objected to the present form, and concludes his letter with these memorable words, which I most heartily wish may make a deep impression on the mind of every gentleman in the opposition. I hesitate not to say that the most fervent prayer of my soul is the establishment of a firm, energetic government, that the most inveterate curse that can befall us is a dissolution of the Union, and that the present moment, if suffered to pass unemployed, can never be recalled. I shall therefore cling to the Union as the rock of our salvation, and urge Virginia to finish the salutatory work which she hath begun. And if after our best efforts for amendments they cannot be obtained, I scruple not to declare, notwithstanding the advantage of the declaration may give to the enemies of my proposal, that I will, as an individual citizen, accept the Constitution."
Okay, so the person that he's quoting here is Governor Randolph. And so he's kind of reading this as Randolph went into the convention. So, and this is kind of how it happened. He went into the convention as a delegate to the Constitutional Convention, as a delegate, and Madison, unbeknownst to him, Madison had this plan of a government. And as they sat with Mason, Randolph, Madison, and the other three men that were there, I think they had a five-team delegation. This is when I think Randolph started actually seeing, the need. And so they presented the plan and we kind of moved forward with what Madison had created for the Virginia plan, because Randolph basically says, "I, as the governor, will present this as our plan," instead of it being just a Madison suggestion. So that way it was being presented as a state plan for what to do. And as he started deliberating with the rest of the men, because he didn't realize all of the problems in the Union. And you can't, because you're working in your own little paradigm. I mean, they didn't have the nightly news what's going on in Los Angeles. Right? They don't see the protests that, are going to sweep across America later on this month as the communists are trying to overthrow us, continually do these things. We see these things today, but we are given information to direct us into conclusions that are not correct. My point is that, this is a very candid vision and a candid report from Governor Randolph that Reverend Stillman wanted to first share. So now, as he says, he pauses and goes forward. Now he starts talking about the Constitution. And so we're going to pick up where he focuses on the delegated powers and abuses. Now back to where you were.
All right.
Thank you.
Back to where I was.
All right.
"The powers that are granted to Congress by this instrument are great and extensive. But, sir, they are defined and limited, and in my judgment sufficiently checked, which I shall prove before I sit down. These powers have been the subject of long and ingenious debate, but the arguments that have been made use of against delegating these powers to the general governments prove too much, being applicable to all delegated power. I mean the possible abuses of it. The very term government implies a supreme controlling power somewhere, a power to coerce whenever coercion shall be necessary, of which necessity government must be the judge. This is admitted. If so, the power may be abused. Every gentleman must confess that we cannot give a power to do good, but it may be abused to do evil. If a merchant commits the care of a ship and cargo to the master, he may dispose of both and appropriate the money to his own use. If we raise a body of men and put arms into their hands for our defense, they may turn them against us and destroy us. All these things prove, however, that in order to guard as much as possible against the abuse of those powers we delegate to the government, there ought to be sufficient checks on them. Every precaution should be used to secure the liberties of the people on the land, on the one hand, and not render government inefficient on the other. I believe, sir, such security is provided in this Constitution. If not, no consideration shall induce me to give my voice in its favor. But the people are secured by the following circumstances. Do you want me to keep going?
Yeah, keep going, yeah.
Okay, so the first one is the Electorate College. Mm-hmm. First, all the offices in the Congress are elective, not hereditary. The President and the Senators are to be chosen by the interposition of the legislatures of the several states who are the representatives and guardians of the people, whose honor and interest will lead them in all human probability to have good men placed in the general government. Second, the representatives in Congress are to be chosen every second year by the people of the several states. Consequently, it lies with the people themselves to say who shall represent them. It will, then, be their own fault if they do not choose the best men in the Commonwealth. Who are Congress, then? They are ourselves, the men of our own choice, in whom we can confide, whose interest is inseparably connected with our own. Why is it, then, that gentlemen speak of Congress as some foreign body, as a set of men who will seek every opportunity to enslave us? Such insinuations are repugnant to the spirit of the Constitution. But a worthy gentleman from Middleborough has told us that though they may be good men when chosen, they may become corrupt. They may so. Nor is it the power of angels or men to prevent it. But should this be the case, the Constitution has made provision for such an event. When it happens, we shall know what method to adopt in order to bring them to punishment. In all governments where offices are elective, there ever has been and there ever will be a competition of interests. They who are in office wish to keep in, and they who are out to get in, the probable consequences of which will be that they who are already in place will be attentive to the rights of the people because they know that they are dependent on them for future election, which can be secured by good behavior only. Besides, they who are out of office will watch them who are in with a most critical eye in order to discover and expose their malconduct, if guilty of any, that they so may step into their places.
Now, everything's been perverted since then, because in these days, the only people that were able to vote were those people willing to pay their taxes. Because you got to remember, property tax was voluntary. When you, the only reason you would pay a property tax, which was a poll tax, to vote. So in other words, yeah, you want to vote in government? Then pay your taxes. By doing that, it really helped people understand the importance of their voice, that, you know, there needs to come a cost with this. By just giving everybody the ability to ask or to inject, in a way, it perverts a Republican form of government by making it a democracy. Right, wrong, or indifferent, we have evolved into a point where all people should be able to at least elect their representatives. But that should be it, right? Because in a Republican form of government, you basically, that's who you vote for. The reality is that we've been duped into believing that as long as the people in office believe, you know, if we want them to do something, then they'll go ahead and do it. The concept of enumerated powers, that they can only do these things, has completely been obliterated. this concept of what he was talking about of the delegated powers gone. They're literally gone. Okay, so now he's going to go into the petition and militia. But this, you know, when you look at how they're talking about this, because we see this isn't flying today, right? You know, this people are getting elected because of money. Those who actually pay, because we've allowed our elections to be literally sold, or our government is being sold out to the highest bidder and whoever's willing to pay. There are checks and balances, like the 17th Amendment didn't actually undermine our control over the Senate, the state legislature's control. You know, we allowed them to convince us that it did. And every state legislature is just completely dumbfounded in what to do. They have no idea that they could actually reel in their senators. They just don't understand the Constitution. This goes back to how important it is to stop being ignorant regarding the laws. Anyway, let's go into the petition and the campaign. We got less than 2 minutes, so let's... This is a long one.
And maybe the first paragraph.
Yeah, go ahead and let's just start off with the first paragraph. Yeah.
Every gentleman knows the influence that a desire to obtain a place or the fear of losing it hath on mankind. Mr. Borg tells us that towards the close of the 7 years for which the representatives are chosen in the British Parliament, they become exceedingly polite to the people. Why? Because they know there is an approaching election depending. This competition of interest, therefore, between those persons who are in and those who are out of office will ever form one important check to the abuse of power in our representatives.
Yeah, and that was one of the arguments in Massachusetts that they wanted to actually have, you know, these guys constantly campaigning. In other words, elect them every year and do it every year instead of 7 years or instead of 2 years or 4 years or whatever. So
every year, that'd be hard.
Yeah, it would, because basically they said that they would never get anything done because they'd be constantly campaigning.
Yeah.
Right. So I get it. I understand. What we have is the closest thing to perfect that could ever be given under this Constitution. The fact is here that we have lost sight of the powers, roles, responsibility, the objects that are enumerated in that Constitution, what they can do, what the standards are, you know, and what they can't do. Or actually, if it's not listed, they can't do it. And the only reason they're giving us welfare is because we asked them and they started giving it to us. Because, okay, well, now we're happy. We've got welfare. We've got, you know, more and more regulations, more and more handouts. The bottom line, folks, is they don't have the authority to do any of it. With that, any comment? Thank you so much, by the way.
You're welcome.
All right. So, and we need to find out when the anniversary is, when you started. But that all being said, folks, going through the ratification debates really helps galvanize, you know, how this Constitution was constantly being justified in its ratification for everybody to step forward, not as a leap of faith, but actually stepping forward into a better government. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.